Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hello, Ruckers, and welcome to this week's episode of the podcast, the rugby podcast from The Times and Sunday Times. We've reached the halfway stage of the Gallagher Premiership season. Joining me in the studio is Alan Dimmock, features editor of Rugby World magazine, and Stephen Jones, a man who needs no introduction. And coming up on the pod is Ross Hamilton, former analyst for England and Saracens, who will talk us through all the statistical and tactical trends that he's spotted in this first half of the season. Gents in the studio, good morning, Al. Good morning, Steve.
Hang on, I want an introduction.
You want an introduction?
Yeah, we say, I don't want to sit here every week and say, needs no introduction. Because at the end of it, people will wonder, who the hell's this?
Yeah, I don't think anyone's going to wonder that.
All right.
Okay, Stephen Jones, multi-award winning correspondent for the Sunday Times and Tottenham fan.
That's a bit better. Thank you very much.
Are you proud of both of those things, or...?
Yes, not too good when we were 1-0 down to Morecambe, though. I'll tell you that.
I have to say, there was a lot of mirth about that around the Rico.
Oh, yeah,
it's
very
not the Rico,
funny, yeah.
It's the Coventry Building Society Stadium.
Listen, try having an affinity for Newcastle United. It's difficult sitting here with that.
go on Cambridge, eh? So other than the FA Cup, what rugby did we see this weekend, Steve? Where were you?
Well, I saw three games. I saw Bristol on Friday, which I thought was wonderful. Not a brilliant, all-round brilliant game, but tremendous conclusion and absolutely fascinating. On Saturday, I was at Stoop, pouring with rain, but you wouldn't have known it with the standard of play. Stuart Barnes' love child, Marcus Smith, kicked a penalty.
He should write a column about him.
Kicked a conversion to win the game, therefore giving Barnesy the excuse to say that Marcus Smith won the game. Well, he kicked the conversion. He certainly didn't win the game. And thirdly, yesterday, on TV only, I'm afraid, I watched a great game between Watson and Leicester. So, honestly, a tremendous Premiership weekend. And we forget during COVID that I don't think the Premiership has ever been so good.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, we say it most weeks on here that the league has never been stronger. And some of the matches, but also the narratives, that Bristol Sale game that we talked about, there are two teams there who are massively underperforming compared to what we thought they would do and what their resources should be allowing them to do. So there was a lot on the line in that one game alone, because they needed to kickstart this sort of second half of the season and try and find themselves again. And Bristol, I thought, did show that. Sale's still struggling.
Yeah, I think we'll get into it in a lot more detail, but certainly there are some teams that are delighted to get that first half of the season away and will probably banish it to the bin of their minds, and there are other teams that are rearing to go. Plenty to chat about at the halfway point of winners and losers and all that, and we'll jump right into it. I'm just looking forward to us batting it back and forth like a game of kick tennis, like the 17 kick phase that we saw in the Championship the other week. Was it Jersey Reds and Bedford Blues? 17 kicks.
Yeah. But then there was a sublime try scored in that game later on, which hasn't had anywhere near as many views on social media, funnily enough.
I'm all for it. Brinkmanship.
Imagine the neck of the crowd. You're going like this at the end of it.
I was thinking of the big front row lads who by the end were just standing on the halfway line waiting
to each other.
Right, well, that's all to come on the right. We've got Premiership chat. We've got Ross Hamilton. We have Jess Hayden giving her update on the Allianz Premier 15s. And our usual weekly God or Goddess of the Week feature. Right, so we've hit the halfway stage, and as we said just now, that so many different narratives at play, so many compelling games across the Premiership weekend. Let's start at the Stoop in the rain, Steve, because one of the stats that struck me from last season was when Harlequins went on their run, which was started about now, all the way through to the final, they didn't play one wet weather game, and they ended up having to come back in a sort of southwest London monsoon on Saturday. How did they do it? What caught your eye? We know what caught Stuart Barnes' eye.
Well, first of all, it's a very, very good point. It was really monsoon-like, but you had to really scratch your head, because normally, in years gone by, not that long ago, if it was pouring with rain, you would then assume automatically that it was going to be a poor game. This one, you actually forgot it was raining. There were a lot of kicks up in the air for position, because it was always a tight game, but the idea that you're disadvantaged when you got a man off the field, which Exeter did at half time, that's slightly in abeyance as well, because Exeter were very, very unfortunate, in my opinion, not to win, because the second half, the way they managed it was absolutely brilliant, and they only allowed one real phase of attack in the last 20 minutes. So that was the one where they scored the winning try. So I tell you what, it was a tremendous game. I thought Exeter was superb. I thought Quins have got a real, first of all, the atmosphere there. When those of us who've been going to Quins for 300 years, and there used to be real two man and a dog thing, the atmosphere was absolutely unbelievable. It was like being at Pontypool Park in the old days or whatever. But, you know, there was so much fascination. You could see why Marcus Smith and Alex Dombrandt are highly rated. But in my opinion, you could also see why they are not shoo-ins for the team, because they had strengths and weaknesses. I just think that Exeter are really close to being back, but not quite. If they would have won with 14 had they been at their best. But a fantastic Premiership afternoon, great day out, and no doubt a few drinks afterwards.
You know what I love about just this introduction to that game here is the fact that we're talking about how entertaining and fun it was, and at no point has anyone gone, "Oh, the red card. The red card ruined it as a contest." I hate when people say that, and this game proved that was a cup of Horlicks, because just it was blood and thunder, as Steve says, in the second half, and there was lots of intrigue to where it was going. But that was a stuck-on red card. Hepburn deserved to go and not come back. For those that didn't see it, it was almost like a pile driver from WWE into the ground with Joe Marler's neck, and he was lucky to avoid injury. I think there was shades of 2005 Lions tour, wasn't it, with that and getting hoisted up by two guys and dropped on his head. But exceptional game, and it's interesting. It's funny. We've spoken on this podcast quite a few times in recent weeks about where important players and transfers and teams keeping hold of guys. Well, this weekend, I think more than any other, showed how important it is to have guys that can kick points. And realistically, it was a missed kick. There was three kicks that were the difference in this game. Now, you know, Marcus Smith hoisted over a couple that were missed that could have led to potential tries. In the end, he got the crossfield kick to Esther Hazen, which led to a try. Phenomenal play right at the death. And then kicked a beautiful curling effort from the touchline to win it. On the other side, Joe Simmons missed the kick that would have potentially meant that this was a draw beforehand. And actually, it shows you the value of that. So it had everything. I think it was fantastic.
Where I think Stuart was right, Steve, in identifying Smith, is particularly his ambition, his desire to keep attacking when the pressure's on. We saw it in that South Africa game. Not dissimilar circumstances in that South Africa had piled on England and England were in a deep hole, and they played their way out of it to win that game. And that's what I felt in those closing stages, that they didn't go into their shell and try and batter their way over the line. He created those opportunities by, I wouldn't say chancing his arm, because he's got the skill set to execute it, but he found a way to win the game. And that attitude is what impresses me.
Possibly, I think he has got a great attitude, but I think he will always make mistakes. And the other thing is, in all sitting together, we were thinking, look, Exeter got eight forwards. They replaced a forward and they took away a back. And for God's sake, why aren't Quins trying to take them on behind? And the kick to Esterhuizen, which won the game, was way overdue because they were a back short. So all he had to do was drive it a little bit, and Esterhuizen could have caught the ball and gone over if he'd hailed a taxi. So that was odd. I think that with Marcus Smith, there'll always be a debate. He's always going to win games, and I think he has got the capacity to lose them as well.
It's that whole fly half debate will continue. Now, England named their squad on January the 18th for the Six Nations. Owen Farrell won't have played a game by that point, and we're back in the situation with him as we were a year ago, where he hasn't played. He hasn't played since November. George Ford has played, and you would imagine, especially if they can secure a bigger squad, which Eddie Jones is trying to, because of the COVID issues that all teams are going to face, that maybe there might be room for George to come back in. We'll wait and see, but the debate won't end for exactly the reasons you point out, Steve.
No, it won't. I mean, look, I'm afraid that I see the point with COVID. For God's sake, at some time, Eddie has got to make some choices, not just put everybody in. So the problem is...
But if his choice is Marcus Smith...
If we extend the squad, then he'll be able to fiddle more choices in. I think that the choice is probably between... the choice, in my opinion, is between Marcus Smith and Owen Farrell. Will Owen Farrell... finally be deserted after all the loyalty that's been shown to him? And it's a great conundrum. I don't know what you think, Al, but Owen has got no form whatsoever, and he will be put in. I admire the bloke massively and always have, but he will be chosen on his last great performance, which is a long, long time ago. So has Eddie really got the bottle now to leave out Owen Farrell? It's as simple as that.
Yeah, and the key point for me there is that Steve said there'll always be debate, and thank God for that, because how boring would this game be if it was all full of certainties? And certainly games like that, I mean, we talked about how magnificent this Premiership weekend was because there were so many tight games, because there were so many close calls. And I don't know if you can sense a theme coming from me, lads, but there's in terms of the kicks that changed the game, we switched to Saracens, and Steve mentioned that they didn't have Owen Farrell. Alex Lazowski is an incredible player, and they're delighted to keep their hands on him, and he's a phenomenal talent. But again, a couple kicks from him that went awry was the difference between winning and losing that game. All credit to Gloucester and what a season they've had, and I'm sure we can dig into later on in our chat with Ross, we can dig into what it is that Gloucester do and that makes them so good. And that's, we talk about line-out drives and how important they are, and certainly they've made an art form of that, and certainly they're more than just that. There's a great togetherness with that squad at the moment, but if Saracens had clipped a couple kicks, they would have been the difference. And Owen Farrell was watching from the stands, and my God, they probably wish they had him on the field.
Yeah, it goes back to one of the conversations we had after that South Africa game, actually, where a lot of people said, oh, well, England only won because Pollard missed some kicks. Well, that's part of the game.
That's rugby,
lads. You don't. Onto that Gloucester game, Saracens 24, Gloucester 25. It's a statement win for Gloucester, isn't it? Does that not sort of validate all the progress that they've made this season? A lot of it's sort of gone slightly under the radar, I think. They found themselves in the upper reaches of the league without people almost realising how well they're playing. And this has really thrust them right into the headlines.
It's the sort of result they've been looking for years. Yeah. For years.
Well, 13 years.
Exactly. Since 2008 was the last time they won away to Saracens. So, I mean, phenomenal. And the thing is that there's not fireworks going off and heralds marching down the street. Thing about this, it's just kind of like, well, we'll just continue cracking on with business as it's gone with Gloucester at the moment. And it's, you don't want to say they're unflashy, because that's unfair, but there's something craftsmanlike about the way that they've eked out wins and beaten teams like Saracens this season. I mean, I say that they're more than just a mole, but it's bloody effective when they do use it.
Yeah.
Is heralds going down the street? We've gone back to Tudor times.
Take off your ruff.
What I like about the way they've gone about it is they've built this rolling mall, which is phenomenally effective. But they've also got threats out wide, so you can't just pile in everything to stop them all, because standing out wide, you've got Hastings, you've got Harris, you've got Atkinson, you've got Zammit, May. You know, they've got so many threats that they, as a defending team, you've got to try and work out how to spread your resources when you're against the most effective rolling maul in the league and a back line that can cut you apart. And just to add to that, the way that the coaching team have built it, it's a young coaching team with, you know, Dominic Waldock in charge of defence, and George Skivington as DOR, and Alex King has brought a bit more experience over with him from France. It's, you know, they've over the course of 18 months or so have forged a really effective unit.
I tell you what, it also shows that, you know, you either bring in six coaches from six different areas like Eddie Jones, or you bring in your own group. But this is people where George Skivington has really plucked from here and there. And it looks like, as far as we know, as you say, Alex, it looks like it's bedded down really well. Mm. I've always had this thing that with Gloucester, that they've always got this thing of getting away from what Gloucester's all about and trying to play attacking rugby, but on no basis. Now I think that they need, they're one or maybe two forwards short, really big tough forwards up front, of being a title contending team. I really do, and I think George Skivington has done an excellent job, and I've always said I will hope before I retire that Gloucester, I will be able to report on Gloucester, unashamedly I say this, Gloucester winning the title, because I think they're a great club and always have been.
On the that sort of traditions line, do you think how much of the Shed were fearful when they relayed the pitch and put an AstroTurf field down at King's Home, that would be, you know, that would take the club, they'd be out trying to play all this fancy stuff, and actually as it's happened they've laid down an Astro pitch and they're mauling it than ever.
They didn't tell the Shed, they haven't realised. They said, blimey, this pitch is not cutting up at all. No, they didn't tell them. They just said it's sort of light green grass, it's real grass. The Shed didn't realise.
So let's stay in the West Country, and that Bath Worcester game. You talk about red cards, Al, not ruining a match. I mean, but Bath scraped home 22-19 against the Worcester side, who spent 78 minutes with 14 men.
Yeah, I do feel for Rory Sutherland, who's before the game, I think he went on social media and said it'll be great to get a run of games together for the team. I've spent too much time in and out, like the Hokey Cokey with injury. He didn't say that, I'm paraphrasing. But with injury, it'll be good. And 2 minutes into the game, he got a red card. But so close. Am I right in thinking that's 211 days since Bath last won a game?
Yeah.
I mean, yes. Incredible stuff. Like, you know, great. You could feel the relief coming off people in Bath, like steam after that one. Certainly, you know, a good way to start the new year. They'll be absolutely buzzing to get that in. But as with Bath all season, they made hard work of it.
Mm. It was a day, right, earlier in the day, I'd seen the clip from the Bangladesh-New Zealand test match where I can't remember which batsman it was. Yeah, he scored a seven anyway. He three to the boundary and then four overthrows. And it felt like that as Bath yesterday. They won the game and then got awarded 2 points from an earlier game and finished the day. They started the day on 4 points in the league and finished it on 10.
Don't look a gift pandemic in the mouth. No.
Lads, I'm sure we're united in disagreeing with the Southern Hemisphere thing, where you can come after whatever it is, 10 or 15 minutes, when someone's been sent off, you can bring on another player. I have to say, after 2 minutes, just wonder whether you tend a little bit, or a little bit more sympathetic. It's totally, I'm not seeing the incident. It's totally Worcester's fault if they lose a man. But then you think, God, 78 minutes, should there just be some sort of, I'm not agreeing with it, but I slightly saw the point of what they do in the Southern Hemisphere.
It's an interesting discussion. For me, I think if you transgress, you deserve to be splapped, but also, again, thinking about it, what makes this game great is, for a start, you know, there was 3 points in it. Regardless, that's, you know, Alex said earlier, you didn't make your kicks. Oh, that's part of the game. You got to suck it up and deal with it. And in this one, think of how incredible it would be for the club if they'd come through and won that. I've got a red card a couple of minutes in. Like, that would be, we'd be talking about that for ages. And certainly, I sometimes think in the back of my head, I'm guilty, personally guilty, of not talking enough about Worcester and digging into them enough. But if they'd won that, certainly they would deserve to have a lot more chat. As it is, we already had a storyline with Bath getting the win. And there was another stat about them that I think you were passed on, Alex, about them and Leicester Tigers.
Oh, yeah. So Will Keller, who joins us at the Times today is his first day, Monday, messaged me during the Leicester game yesterday. I was up in Coventry, so Sunday was the first time since April the 18th, 2021, where Bath had won and Leicester had lost on the same Premiership weekend. And that was only because Bath beat Leicester 21-20 on that occasion back in spring 2021.
I mean, it's Bath have won and Leicester. Bath have won their first game of the season. Leicester have lost their first game of the season. They're still stuck. Leicester Tigers are still slap bang at the top of the Premiership table, 8 points ahead. Bath are still rock bottom. But I don't know. Do you think for Leicester that this is maybe a good thing that they can't crack on thinking they're invincible? That actually maybe this is the boot up the backside.
I did.
Not that they need one, but it can help.
Just on the Bath thing first. I think. In a lot of ways, Worcester will take more out of that game than Bath because of the fight they showed. Bath needed that win, as we said, they needed it. I don't think they played in a way that will have convinced them that everything's fine and dandy down at the Wreck. I mean, it took them a long time to put away a 14-man spirited Worcester team. And then up in Coventry, I was thinking that as we talked to Steve Borthwick afterwards, that I've seen Leicester win late a lot this season, and it almost felt inevitable that they were going to do it again. And I just think sometimes,
Thanos,
sometimes you just need it. You almost need that reality check to realise that sometimes you've got to fight for everything. And I'm not saying they weren't fighting for it, but you can't assume it's going to happen every time. And 15 wins in a row, they were one short of matching the record from 83-84 when that Leicester team started their season with 16 straight wins. And listen, again, missed kicks. George Ford missed two very kickable penalties in the first half, which could have seen off Wasps, actually.
But on the other side, and I know that this is playing to the gallery a little bit, I can see Steve out the corner of my eye here, is what an incredible steward Jimmy Gopperth is. You know, like, that's a Wasps team that's... I saw some people say 15, I saw some people say 16 players out, frontline players. They had injuries in the warm-up and all that, but 38-year-old Jimmy Gopperth just sort of marshalling things around the game. And there's a... I once heard Steve Jones say over a lunch that if you could pick a player to kick a goal to try and win it at the end, Jimmy Gopperth is right up there. And thank God that they've got that bit of experience in there with all the turmoil that they've got. But on the other side as well, you've got, I mean, true grit from Wasps. Brilliant. I mean, everything on paper was against them from that one. They've had a weird season, I would say, and an injury hit one, and a lot of changes in the pack. But certainly some guys in their forward pack and really pulled off some heists on that game at the weekend. And it's just admirable.
And they tried to play Leicester at their own game. They were kicking long, trying to play territory, and had no luck with, no success with it in the first half. They got lucky with what ended up being a penalty try, where a clearance from Wolstenholme got touched in flight, and they ended up going 80 metres, and they were given the penalty try at the end. It was a fortuitous piece of play. They were sort of down on energy. They weren't making any ground. They were Charlie Atkinson, who I think is a really promising, lovely fly half, but just looked rusty. He'd not played for 4 months, and Leicester should have been further ahead. And then after the interval, was changed the way they played. Jimmy Gopperth was taking the ball to the line more. Will Porter came on at scrum half, brought real energy, and they were down to the bare bones. Robin Hislop had to start the game at loose head, promoted off the bench on the morning of the game, injured his knee after 8 minutes, soldiered on to about the hour, and when they bring on their fifth choice academy prop, who'd been marmalised by Harlequins last time he played, and somehow that all fed the emotion and the
it's kind of like the Alamo, guard, wasn't it?
Yeah, the spirit, and Leicester had five scrums on Wasp's 5 metre line, and that's where you felt it was inevitable, and yet somehow from the depths of their being and their soul, I haven't studied every scrum, I'm sure Ellis Genge will have a few questions about how once Wasps were on a warning, the next two were given as resets. But they survived it, and Alfie Barbary pulled off a turnover under the post to crown another brilliant performance. I thought Dan Frost came on, was superb at hooker. James Gaskell, back from injury, brought some real wisdom and experience. And it was, it was, as Lee Black is afterwards, it was a victory founded on emotion. And I thought it, and fair play to them. I thought it was brilliant.
I think it was emotion, but also it's interesting when the fifth reserve prop came on. He actually introduced himself to Dan Frost. He says, I don't believe we met before. The way that the last two scrums of those as you say, Alex, it was done and dusted. They were either going to get a penalty try or they're going to get a try. But the way that actually was found a way to go forward, or at least the right hand side went forward in those last two scrums and forced Ben Young to get the ball out. I actually thought, frankly, it was an emotion, but I thought their defensive organisation, considering that they were really on their backsides and on their uppers in terms of personnel, defensive organisation in the last phases of play was absolutely superb. And it got sort of George Ford like twice during that last bit. He sort of stopped dead because no one was sort of coming off him, and I just think that was suggesting. I didn't think they're a great club as a Leicester, but I just think it's a great win.
Yeah, just with that though, it depends which way. There are two ways to go now for Wasps with this. Either you utilise that and you use that as something as a springboard, and you go right. No more talking about the injuries and everything else. We're expecting players to come back, some great players to come back, in fact, and we'll crack on. Or maybe they don't use it, and then this is the high point of their season. So we're interesting now. We're at this precipice of this. The next game in the league is the big one for Wasps. How do they use this?
Yeah,
you know, harness this emotional energy, because either it's an outburst or it's something special that kickstarts things. And as you say, there are exciting talents in there, and hopefully just. Thank God we'll see some big names coming back for them.
Well, Paolo Adogu is due back within the next fortnight. Joe Launchbury is not far off.
Dan Robson's not far off.
Tom West should have been back this week.
Tom would have played, but was ill.
Yeah, Ryan Mills is now fit to play.
Yeah.
So they're much better.
Yeah, but on Gopeth, it seems like he's off to Leicester next season, which I asked Steve Borthwick about afterwards, and he just said we talk about announcements when we want to make an announcement. But from everything we hear, they're going to sign Jimmy Gopeth to perform a similar role to that Richard Wigglesworth is performing, which is, you know, an experienced head around the squad, cutting his teeth as a coach, can fill in when Andre Pollard's away with South Africa, can play 12 as well. Yeah. I think if that does end up going through, that's a very, very smart signing for Leicester, and a loss for Wasps, because I had him marked as just sort of seamlessly transitioning into the coaching team there. But
and this, like, this might sound very harsh and very uncharitable, but if Jimmy goes, I think the focus is very, very much then on Wasps and Jacob Umanga, because I'm not sure he's a promising lad. I'm not sure if he's the man who's going to take Wasps back to glory at 10. I think he's a little bit sort of full of guts, full of energy, but not quite the sort of the finished article. And they've got it wrong once with Lima Sopoanga as a 10, and they've got to get it right next year.
The other transfer news, if you could call it that, is that Chris Boyd isn't going to renew his contract as director of rugby at Northampton at the end of the season, and he'll head back to New Zealand. They put 44 points on Newcastle. He's incredibly popular as a DOR, and it sounds like they might look to promote from within there.
Well, certainly, if you speak to Chris Boyd, one of the big directors for them since he came in was bringing on young English coaches.
Yeah.
He's talked a lot about that. There's certainly some talent in the room, but Saints just, they need to take a next step. So if whoever comes in and takes over, continuity means that you can't say, right, okay, well, we're starting a new project or that. So you've got to take a step forward.
That's one to watch over the next few days. Coming up next, Ross Hamilton, the former analyst for England and Saracens, will join us to dissect all the tactical trends and statistics from this first half of the Gallagher Premiership season.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
So Ross, a bit of a layup here, but what trends have we noticed so far at the halfway point of this season?
Yeah. Hi guys. Big one for me here is something we call red zone efficiency. Red zone efficiency is how many points each team comes away with per entry to the red zone, which is the opposition 22. And why I'm sort of bringing this up is what for me the biggest law change that's had the most effect on the game is this being held up over the line and having a goal line dropout. I've got a few stats here to sort of show the relevance and how it's changed. One of them we look at is something we correlate. We correlate the stats to winning rugby matches. So it tries to show us which is the most important factors in the game. Now, of course, there are multiple and they're all intertwined, but red zone efficiency comes up every season as the most correlated stat to winning a rugby match. So if you outperform your opposition in the red zone, you're more likely to win that game. So the importance of that hasn't diminished. However, the success probably has dropped a little bit. So I averaged out all of the teams and how many times they get into the red zone in the first place. Now that's actually gone up this season. So from 13.4 on average per game last season to 14.7. But their total points have gone down. So their red zone efficiency has gone down as well. Now, last season is 1.62 on average, and this season 1.43. Now, I know those are very small margins as well, and he's thinking that's sort of a tiny difference. If I give you just one real world example quickly and give you the best teams who are performing in this category, last season was Quins. They averaged 2.1 points per entry, every entry. This season it's Saracens at 1.68. So that difference is 0.42. But as I said, if teams are averaging around 14 entries per game, that makes a difference of 5.9 points per game, every game. So 6 points in every match for each team is quite a big difference, even in just winning one match. But if you go and correlate that across the course of the season, that is then a big difference and a big drop off. And I think for me, all down to that law change.
Yeah, looking at your statistics that you furnished us with here, Ross, I imagine you could assume that Bristol are, you know, you've pointed out that Bristol are the worst here in terms of red zone efficiency, but who's the biggest loser since last season with this?
Statistically, that answer is Exeter, and I think that was perhaps unsurprising because of the way that they played. No surprise, again, they've done it for years and been very successful at it. They build pressure in the red zone. They tap and go from 5 metres out, play multiple phases and eventually get the score. And that's been taken away from them because if they get held up over the line, it's a goal line dropout and they don't just get a 5 metre scrum again. So statistically, that is the case for Exeter. They averaged 1.99 points per entry last year. And that was second best to Quins. They're now 1.33 and that puts them in ninth overall for the league. So second to ninth in the course of sort of one season, a half a season, really.
It's a hell of a swing, isn't it?
Huge swing and a massive difference. And we said that's a bigger drop than the best ones from Quins to Saracens. So how many points that actually equates to Exeter losing out on every game is huge. And obviously then has a factor in them winning matches.
Just on that, Ross, you mentioned there a few times the law change and the dropout situation. Have there been any other consequences from that change?
Yes, for me, that change came in, that law came in to force teams to be a little bit more expansive. You can't see me, but I'm doing this in inverted commas, to be a little bit less boring. just pick and going multiple phases around the try line every single time with a scrum to reset just became a little bit too much, perhaps. They wanted teams to test themselves, to stretch themselves, score tries perhaps quicker where they could. And we have certainly seen that. So one of the stats that we have available to us is scoring tries by phase. So we have all the phases that you can have in a game. You can have obviously up to 20, 30 phases in a possession. And then just where the tries are scored in that. So I looked at tries scored within three phases. So a fairly quick turnaround from the start of your possession to the end of it. And whether a try was scored in three phases. At this point last season, halfway through, they'd scored, all teams had scored 208 tries. This point in the season, it's 305. So nearly 100 more at the same point in the season. And to give that a bit of context as well, that's 47% increase. I mean, 47% increase for anything is enormous. If you were thinking of a 5%, 10% increase, that's a pretty big deal. You're nearly at 50% increasing that number. It is certainly a notable shift. And I think clearly, again, it's linked to that. I don't think that's come from nowhere. It's forced those teams to score earlier, be more clinical, play the ball out wide where there's a little bit more space, not just repeatedly go through phases trying to break them down, because there's actually so much risk there in getting held up over the line now.
It's an interesting byproduct, that, isn't it? I remember speaking recently to Tony Brown, who's the Highlanders coach and Japan assistant coach, and he was talking about how Japan, from 2019 onwards, all they wanted to do was try and get strike moves. They wanted to score as early as possible from phase play, and every set piece they did, they wanted to score almost immediately, and which seems like a cultural change within the game, and it seems like people were picking it up and running with it. Just from that, Ross, who do we see creating the most try-scoring opportunities, and if there's different ways of getting into that, because there's more than one way to skin a cat?
Certainly, yes. I mean, penalties discipline is still a huge factor of the game. And if we're talking about sort of red zone efficiency being the highest correlator to winning matches, that's still important. So I had a look at sort of who used their penalties the best or got into the right areas the most. And then what those teams do with that off the back of that, because having the chance in the first place is one thing, but scoring it is another. So of all the penalties that the team have, Sale kick the most into the 22. Now, 66% of all their penalties are kicked into the 22. So they give themselves a lot of opportunities. And just to give you a second and third for that, Exeter at 63%, Gloucester at 63% as well. So those teams are really looking to utilize their possession and penalties to get into the right areas. Now, off the back of that, a lot of teams have a lot of lineouts in that area. And some really good success rates, but they're not always converting that into tries. And why we're sort of talking about this point is that tries from line out is a specific source, the original source. That doesn't necessarily mean directly from a maul. It just means a line out in the first place. It's still the highest factor or stat to scoring tries. So 54% of all tries come from line outs, and that is across multiple sources of scrums, restarts, taps, turnovers, kicks. So 54% from just one source is a huge amount, and again, one of the most important factors. So Leicester have a lot of lineouts in the 22. Wasps actually have the best success in the 22 in terms of winning their lineouts. Leicester very high up there. One thing I wanted to point out here was linking back to our points earlier with Exeter. Exeter really are struggling in the 22, and it links into their platform in the first place. So as I mentioned, they kick a lot of penalties to touch. They have a lot of lineouts in the 22 in the first place, but they languish down in 12th for lineout success. They've actually lost the most lineouts in the 22 in the Premiership with 10, and only Worcester have a worse lineout success overall. So they're really struggling in terms of getting their platform in the first place, losing the ball before they even get a chance to go at the line. However, then if we look at the opposite of that, somebody I haven't mentioned so far in this section is Saracens. Saracens don't necessarily kick the most penalties into the 22, don't have the most opportunities in lineouts, don't have the best success rate in terms of winning the lineout initially, but they convert the most into scores, which is the whole point of everything. You can have as many opportunities and chances as you want, but it's all about converting that into tries. So of the lineouts that Saracens have within the 22, 43% of those times of those lineouts are converted into a try. And again, as a strike rate, that's pretty high for one source.
Ross, we've talked a lot about the law change with the goal line dropout, but on the subject of lineouts, how much has the 50-22 law change impacted the way that teams are playing this season in terms of, I don't know, chances created, points scored from them, that kind of thing?
I think it's certainly changed the way teams play. I don't think it's necessarily created many more try-scoring opportunities directly from the 50-22, if you see what I mean by that. And I'll go through some examples. There have been 29 50-22 kicks so far at this point in the season after round 13. So that's 76 games that have been played. Bristol have the most with five, but Sale, for example, have had zero. Leicester at the top of the table have only had one 50-22 kick. Saracens only two. And then to give that even more context, the a total amount of lineouts in the 22 within the Premiership so far is 739. So 29 of those lineouts coming from 50-22 kicks accounts for less than 4%. So it's not necessarily their tactical element that they're trying to gain that lineout. It's obviously a bonus, sure, but it's not giving them the type of platform that they'll be setting out to achieve by a 50-22 kick. I don't think it's sort of much of a surprise. I think we all thought this going into the start of the season with the law change. But what that would do is main teams will have to defend the 50-22 kick, which creates space in the pitch in the first place. So teams playing wider, kicks over the top, that sort of thing. That's where the difference in play has become, not necessarily the outcome itself from the 50-22 kick originally.
Just wondering, Ross, if there's anything else from this mid-season point that really stands out to you, or any teams that you think are sort of been surprise packages so far?
Well, I mean, obviously, not so surprised that Leicester were unbeaten before this weekend. I don't think anybody saw that coming. Not necessarily league-wide trends, but I certainly see that they have changed their style a huge amount. And again, I don't think it's a surprise that that's perhaps a little bit like Saracens used to play with Borthwick at the helm. They very much rely on a very strong defence, kick the ball away. They play with the least amount of possession. They're happy to have the least amount of carries, make the least amount of metres in the Premiership, but they kick the most. And that just gives them field position, playing in the right areas of which they can then capitalise once their opposition make errors under their defensive pressure. Again, nothing new. We see that from Saracens in years gone by. We'd like to think that Leicester might improve sort of their attacking stats perhaps a bit quicker than Saracens did at that time. They are now very good at it. But that is a huge difference in terms of Leicester and why they are being so successful so far this season for me.
Thanks very much, Ross. And we're going to put all the charts and tables of stats that Ross has just been talking about on all our various social media feeds, just for anyone who wants to have an eye on them while they're listening to Ross's analysis, which I thought was excellent. Now, coming up next on The Ruck, Jess Hayden will give her roundup of the Allianz Premier 15s. And we'll have our God or Goddess of the Week.
The Premier 15s returned for the first time in 2022, but just six teams were in action over the weekend following the postponement of Wasps versus Loughborough Lightning and Harlequins versus Worcester Warriors due to a number of players who tested positive for COVID. Despite reigning champions Harlequins being out of action, it was a week of high scores and drama at both the top and bottom of the table. Round 10 kicked off with a West Country derby as Gloucester Hartbury put five tries past Bristol Bears to win 36-14 and move up to fifth place in the table. Next up, Exeter Chiefs won 43-7 against Sale Sharks. The Devon side now sits second in the table but must now prepare to face a well-rested Harlequin side next. And finally, one of the biggest score differences in Premier 15's history, as Saracens scored 18 tries to beat DNP Durham Sharks 104-0. Saracens now sit 2 points clear at the top of the table with a game in hand, but these results are a bad advert for the women's game and reflect the gulf between the top and bottom sides. It's worth remembering that DNP, who do sit bottom of the table, are an entirely amateur squad with little infrastructure around the women's setup, paired against world-class and often semi-professional, if not fully professional, opposition. DNP players took to Instagram to ask people to stop sending them abuse, and while abuse is never warranted, there certainly needs to be a further discussion about the merits of their inclusion in this league, as scorelines such as this do little to help them or further the women's game. Next week, all teams should hopefully be back in action. as well as Exeter versus Harlequins, there's Gloucester Hartbury versus Sale Sharks, Worcester Warriors versus Wasps, DMP versus Bristol Bears, and finally Loughborough Lightning versus Saracens.
Thank you, Jess. And to round off our halfway pod, we have our weekly feature, God or Gordess of the Week. Although I think, Al, you're taking the Mark Evans route and giving us a Devil of the Week.
Well, I did think about it. At the weekend, we saw the first iteration of Japan's League One rugby and the second division of that. If I was to pick a Devil of the Week, it'd be the person that thought it was okay for the Sky Actives and Hino Red Dolphins to wear the exact same kit playing against each other. That must have been fun viewing. However, in the end, I did think, oh, maybe let's go the positive route. And there are a couple of options for God of the Week for me in the top 14, the beloved madhouse that it is. Demba Bamba almost intercepted a ball at the weekend wearing no shirt. Which was exceptional. But actually, remember Vasily Artemyev?
Yes.
Who played for Northampton on the wing.
On the wing,
Russian hero. He is now the presenter of Russia's version of the Ninja Warrior. And he is my God of the Week. Because what a segue from a rugby playing career that is.
Nice.
Al's gone, mate. Completely gone.
We started with WWE
and now we've got... Don't ask him again, for God's sake. He's completely nuts. Oh, that was a good one. Mine is unquestionably the man who's on everyone's lips. Not really. B. Allo. B has been through a number of clubs, has never been a starter. He's always seems to be under pressure and is gutsing things out. But against Wasps, he was one of the front row that had never met before, or hardly met before. And in the last two scrums of the game, When he'd gone backwards, he somehow, with his colleagues, with his cronies, made some ground on his side and disrupted the heel that was obviously going to be a try. Ben Youngs had to play the ball, and earlier on in that move, B appeared on the right wing and made an unbelievable props tackle on a back. So to typify the Wasps heroism, I've got the Wasps reserve tight end, B. Yellow.
Brilliant. I like that. I would want to give a mention to Ryan Mills, who made his comeback for Wasps yesterday after about 18 months of horrific ill fortune and injury. And he got a lovely reception from the crowd in Coventry and well deserved. And as we said earlier, they've got some other players who've going through similar tricky journeys, Launchbury and Jack Willis, and we hope they're back soon as well. But I think I'll give mine to George Skivington for heading up the Gloucester revival, for heading up everything that we discussed earlier, and making the Rolling Mall a thing of beauty in the Premiership once again. So, everyone, I think that's all right. Everyone, thanks for joining us. We're halfway through the Prem season. We're heading into Europe and then the Six Nations. We will be with you all the way on the ruck. Al, Steve, thank you. Everyone, please like, subscribe, follow, whatever you need to do on all your podcast platforms, and we'll be back with you next week.